Welcome back to Dave's Gone By. I'd mentioned on the show that I went back for a second time to one of those big radio media conventions with all these people who were trying to pitch folks from TV and print and media on their books, on their products, on their ideas and stuff, because they wanted to get on the air. They wanted to be part of interviews and sell their stuff or just get publicity for themselves. And one of the nice things about being part of that is not just getting free loot or meeting all these folks and having all these potential interview people to talk to, but also being among peers and colleagues and networking and making friends with those kinds of folks. And one of the fellas that I met is a fellow named Bob Cudmore, who has been doing radio for quite a few years. He's also a bit of a historian of upstate New York. I found him very personable and fun, and I've been on his show once or twice talking about the theater and talking about the conference. So I thought only fair, only righteous to have Bob on Dave's Gone By. So Bob Cudmore, welcome to the neighborhood.
Well, how you doing there, Dave? Good to be with you.
Good to be with you, too. So, Bob, you've been on WVTL in Amsterdam, New York for about 2 years.
Right. The station went talk a little bit before that. And I was kind of looking around for something to do in my elder years. I used to do talk radio. I mean, I basically have done radio on and off for over 40 years. But my big gig left me in 1993, and then I went into public relations. But then I started doing radio again about 4 or 5 years ago, first at another little itty-bitty station up here in upstate New York, and now I'm at a teensy-weensy station in upstate New York. So.
Is VTL, what's like a wattage or
the... It's a 1,000-watt station. It's community radio. We're a community radio station, and we're an isolated enough community, the Amsterdam area. It's in the Mohawk Valley west of Albany, mm-hmm. that it makes sense to talk to the mayor every week and the county sheriff and... the people at the local library and the local museum. Heck, we even do lost cat announcements.
I'm sorry, wash cap announcements?
No, lost cats.
Oh, lost cats.
We could do those others, too, if you wanted.
I hate to say it, but GBB, we haven't really done that in a long time, but back under the previous management, they would do that. If there was a dog or a lost thing, they would announce it every hour and ask all the different program hosts to kind of do a 30-second...
We'll do anything. I mean, we're just trying to, you know, secure some kind of audience, and it seems to be working out. I mean, I have an advantage in Amsterdam in that I'm from there. I don't, in fact, live there right now. I live about 15 miles away, but I'm a native of Amsterdam. My parents live there and so on and so forth, and I know a lot about it. It's an interesting little city. It's almost like a little Brooklyn in that Amsterdam, in its own way, has been this melting pot over the years, you know, with all kinds of different immigrant groups coming in and going out and staying and leaving and fighting with each other.
Well, you're something of a historian of that whole area. I mean, not just in almost a spare time way, but almost like a part-time career thing. Am I right?
Some years ago, I also have done over the years newspaper columns for papers in this up area of upstate New York. I started writing about a city called Nero, New York, which is kind of my own version of Lake Wobegon, the Garrison Keillor place, except Nero's in upstate New York, and the name is pointed in that here upstate, you know, we have a lot of those classical names, you know, Syracuse and places like that, that were named after, Ithaca, the old Greek and Roman names. Mm-hmm. And the point of the Nero story was the people in Nero started the city so late that all the good names like Troy and Ithaca and Syracuse, they were all taken. So they thought Nero sounded good, and it was only after they had the city signs up and everything, they found out that Nero was a corrupt emperor who burned his city down. But by then it was too late to replace the signs.
Hey, don't forget, look, Queens has Flushing, so you guys
there
are
you
ahead
go.
Of the game.
There you go.
I mean, or you heard some
but
of
the... But the thing about
upstate
New York, and it really kind of applies to my native city of Amsterdam, is that we're very depressed people. We're very negative people. You know, whatever the question upstate, the answer is no. You find that out when you come up here. You know, it's like... I don't blame you as a compliment in upstate New York. You know, we're just very negative. We don't think anything's ever going to work out because, you know, the experience of most of us is that the mills moved out 50 years ago and nothing good has happened since.
Are you at least near college towns?
Not too near. Amsterdam may be one of the few, well, Nero's not near a college town for sure, but Amsterdam, my real hometown, is one of the few places, I think, in upstate New York that doesn't have a college. The nearest college is near Johnstown, which is about 10, 15 miles away.
No, I'm sorry to be so ignorant about this, but is Nero made up or is Nero real?
Well, it's hard to tell, but it probably is made up.
Okay, just checking on that.
Yeah, because people do get confused about that. In fact, the paper I write for now always makes me put in a line that says it's a fictional city. But when I do the stuff on the radio, I try to take that out, and so that people really get the sense that it's it could be real or is real. And
Israel is halfway across the globe.
Your Israel is something else altogether. Although, speaking of Israel or something like that, I told you about ethnic groups. Maybe I mentioned this to you. It's one of my stories about Amsterdam, that our most famous person is Jewish. That's
okay.
Kirk Douglas, who was born Isidore Danielovich,
Amsterdam, New York. Oh, my goodness. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah, well, in fact, he wrote a book called The Ragman's Son, which he probably pointed out quite correctly, that Amsterdam was quite an anti-Semitic city, or there certainly was that strain there, and that was true. Although over the years, the city has elected two Jewish mayors.
Mazel tov. And you said how many people are roughly in that area?
Well, in
thousands?
Amsterdam right now, there's about 17,000, and when I was a kid, the population was something like twice that.
Wow, so once those mills went.
Yeah, the mills went south. They were in Amsterdam, they were carpet mills, and my father, in fact, was a carpet weaver.
Cool.
And my grandfather was a weaver, and I'm not.
So how did you go from non-weaving into weaving stories on the radio?
Yeah, I mean, I just always liked radio. I started in radio when I was in high school. I was like 16 years old in Amsterdam. I was my first job, I was the English announcer on the Polish show.
Which means you had to do it in Armenian. So
right,
I did
the commercials in English on the Polish show.
And it was about, what station was that?
Well, that was the other station in town, WCSS by name.
Which still exists?
Yeah, they still exist.
Oh, wow.
It's funny, Amsterdam, oddly enough, is this little hot media market. We've got two radio stations, a daily paper, two other daily papers cover the city. I mean, there's an all-news cable channel who has a bureau there. So, I mean, it's like we haven't learned yet that, that things are bad. You know?
Are there underground nukes or something? Is there a reason that they're keeping that city so...
I don't know. There's a lot of scrutiny up here.
I guess. Well, that's good. Must be a pretty nice place to live, although I'm sure the winters are a little tough.
Well, they are. Yeah, we had snow the other day when the big whatever it was came through after Wilma.
Right.
But not that much snow. But I'm like a lot of people up here. I'm just obsessed with the weather. You know, I watch all three or four or five of the TV weathermen that come out of the big stations, TV stations in Albany, you know. And whenever they start beating the drum, I kind of head down to the basement with my poodle dog and cower in the corner.
Now, speaking of cowering in the corner, let's take you from that Polish show on the radio. How did you go? I mean, did you then grow into other things at that same station, or did you start circulating?
Well, I was at that station when I was in high school.
Right.
And when I went away to college and went to Boston University, which is known for its communications program. Howard Stern went there, but I'm older.
Right.
And but I didn't study communication. I studied English literature because it was Vietnam. Also, I thought I could become a teacher. I could not be drafted, but it turned out I failed the physical. And so after college,
how did you fail? What did they find wrong?
I was overweight and had high blood pressure. Of course, it probably had a lot to do with the donuts I had that morning and the two packs of cigarettes I smoked. But,
right.
It was almost like an Arlo Guthrie story. When I went for my physical, I think there were about three of us that passed. Everybody had some sort of an angle.
Man, those days when they let you out for flat feet.
Oh, I know. Well, they wouldn't do that then, but, you know, I knew I was in good shape when I got on the scale and the sergeant laughed.
Oh, good. So, yeah, I guess if you're packing for like 2 weeks and just like binge way back when.
Yeah.
I guess that was
back.
A great way to just sort of get out of it, you know? Would you have been, was that, what, around what years would that have been? Did that keep you out any more?
67 or 68 that I was drafted. I was still in school. In fact, at Boston U, Boston U was a real hotbed of Eastern Seaboard radicalism.
Cool.
And people I went to school with, I wasn't particularly radical myself, but he was sort of never rose to the level of, Abbie Hoffman or those folks, I don't think, and maybe you've never heard of the man, but...
I know Abbie, I never met Abbie Hoffman, but I know Jerry Rubin.
Our local radical was Ray Mungo, who was kind of sort of a friend of mine back when I was in college. He was the editor of the student paper, one of the first papers to call for the impeachment at LBJ. He later went on to be one of the founders of a commune in Vermont called Total Loss Farm.
Oh,
and
boy.
He also founded the the Liberation News Service, or he's one of the people that was involved in that.
He didn't poison 4,000 people with Kool-Aid, did he?
No. Now he's a stockbroker. He's a teacher and a gay rights activist out in California. I think he teaches English at a community college. So.
Cool.
Those were sort of his glory days, I think, back at Boston U in the 60s.
Were you
he had
part
this RAC counselor then, who was real regular Army, but he thought we should know all the rules about the, you know, the draft. And so he had all the married students, I was married at the time, reject their student deferments, because there was some sort of loophole then. If you took a student deferment, you could never then have a fatherhood deferment. So when I rejected my deferment, I got called up for the Army, and I failed the physical. But those who passed, who were married and later had children, somehow got some kind of exemption because of this. It's some sort of little loophole in the law. They had loopholes even back then.
Well, okay, that's fine. Yeah, I guess if you're white from New York, you have a few more options than if you're black from Missouri.
Amen to that. And also, some of the folks, like our current leaders, you know, were in the National Guard for different times.
Exactly.
You know, National Guard was a different sort of a creature back then. Hi, this is radio personality Bob Cudmore, and you're listening to Dave's Gone By on WGBB.
Back to, out of the Army, into a microphone.
Yeah, well,
that's a weird.
Yeah, I started work backwards in my career. I after Boston University, I worked in radio in Boston.
Sure.
Then I left there and went to Pittsfield, Massachusetts, and lived there for a long time. Lived there for like 10, 11 years at a radio station in Pittsfield, WBEC, in the 1970s, and did the morning show there, and it was wonderful. Just loved it. And then
kind of show was it? Talk? Was it
music? Yeah, talk and music. You know, it was like talk was sort of evolving then.
Mm-hmm.
I would do kind of rather similar to the show I'm doing now, except it was back then. And it was, you know, radio was a bigger deal then. You know, I hate to say that, but it's true. You know, I mean, I probably had never had as much fun or kind of impact on a community as I did on Pittsfield back in the 1970s. You know, we had two little radio stations that ultimately three, and we're all competing like crazy, and it was just a lot of fun. You know, kind of like the days, I suppose, in New York City when they had the WABC and the WINS people fight, you know, competing with each other.
So right.
It was a lot of fun, but the only trouble was, and this is sort of typical of radio, there was no money in it.
Oh.
So eventually I looked around for something else, and then I found something else over in the Capital District, which is where I came from, you know, of upstate New York. So my biggest gig was I worked at WGY in Albany, or technically in Schenectady. We used to actually say Schenectady back then, which is a 50,000-watt AM talk station.
Yeah.
It was Going Talk at the time, and I did the nighttime talk show basically until Rush Limbaugh and Company arrived. And there were two problems with that. I worked there from 1980 to 1993 doing the nighttime talk show, and that was wonderful. You know, it was really kind of the high point of my career in terms of being a big station, or reasonably large
station. Well, 50,000, I mean, that can, you know, if they don't turn the amperage down, that will bounce all the way to Kansas.
Yeah, and it had a good name. It was one of America's oldest radio stations, and when it first was there, it was owned by General Electric, but then, like a lot of things in radio, it was bought and sold 16 ways to Sunday. Now it's owned by Clear Channel, but when I was, the people that let me go, I mean, the place was basically bankrupt. You know, they just had their kind of reverses, but
How did Rush Limbaugh affect everything?
Well, I think it happened to a lot of people in radio then. You were talking the early 90s, you know, 1993. Station's in a fair amount of trouble. You know, the ratings are kind of holding in maybe at night, you know, but we aren't getting the shares. And the thing was, at the time, WGY was staffed round the clock with local hosts. And so they brought in Rush Limbaugh, but they had to pay for him. And so in large part to save money, and there are, you know, different versions about why I was fired, but I really think the basic thing was they just needed to save money, because the money they were paying on Rush Limbaugh and other stations around the country were doing this, they just syndicated the nighttime, because they had to pay Rush Limbaugh, but generally you didn't have to pay to get Tom Likas or whoever else you'd get at night, you know, to be on the station. So that way they were able to save money and get a product, you know, that would be useful. And also, I was not exactly the kind of direction that talk radio was going then. I wasn't a right-wing conservative. I tended to be more of a liberal New Yorker kind of person. So there was also that political aspect to it.
And, well, here you were, I guess, at a certain point, middle age. You've been working in that market for, well, at one station you said you were there for about 10 years. How long were you at GY?
13 years.
13 years.
Yes. That was actually a good long time, established,
So you get fired from something like that. How do you then pick yourself up and say, oh, my God, what next?
Yeah, well, PR, I think I had a family then, and my kids were about ready to go to college. And
which is brutal.
Yeah, I would have loved to have stayed in radio, but I talked to some of the people up here. I didn't really want to move, or that wasn't really an issue. My wife had her own career up here. We could have moved, but and also my parents were still alive in the Amsterdam area, which is near where I was. In fact, I'm still living in the same place I've lived since I came to WGY. So what I did, basically, was what a lot of people do. I went into public relations, and the big employer up here is the state government. I did public relations for the State University of New York for something like 8 years, and that was a good job. You know, I basically walked out of the WGY job, walked into that job, and made about the same amount of money and did that for 8 years and was happy to cash that check every 2 weeks.
Sure. And then it was basically retirement time, and you took
on radio. I mean, it's a little more dramatic than that. Sure. I don't know if I went through this whole thing. My wife passed away in 2001. She had colon cancer, Mary. And so at that time, when she passed away, and she and I discussed this, I mean, we knew she was going to die. I mean, she had one of those prognoses from the doctor that was absolutely accurate. Her doctor told her she had 2 years to live, and she lived just 2 years. And so when she died, my wife and I had discussed, well, what am I going to do? Because I really don't have the responsibilities anymore. So I did one of the things they always tell widows and widowers not to do in the first year after their spouse dies. I quit my job. I mean, I didn't particularly dislike it, but I didn't like it very much. So I decided I wanted to, see what else I could do going back into media. So I kept doing my writing, which I was doing on the side, and I had written this book about Nero, the upstate city, and I was writing some newspaper columns. And by and by, I drifted into some radio jobs, and the WVTL one that I have now is kind of, seems to be okay. I don't know how long I'll do it. I mean, when you get to be my age, everything's short term. I don't exactly expect to do this even for another 5 years, but it's been fun to do radio there. It's my hometown, and in particular, we're kind of creating something out of nothing. I mean, the station had just been simulcasting the FM country stuff that the FM stations that are owned by this little company had been doing, and now all of a sudden we're doing local radio.
Great. By the way, can people listen to your show on the web? Is the station streaming?
Yes, we are streaming, although there are a lot of rocks in our stream. It doesn't always work. But
I believe we've been there. Well, there were
but
many years we didn't.
We do stream. It's 1570 WVTL.
1570WVTL.com.
Correct.
To hear the Bob Cudmore Show, Monday through Friday, 6 to 10 a.m. I mean, that's 4 hours, and it's not like you have a big zoo behind you. I think it's just you.
Well, yes, I do it along with another colleague of mine from the old WGY days, honestly. His name's Dave Green. I don't know. I think when you were on the show, you might have heard Dave come in and out. Dave basically is my gardener, and that's his business. After he left radio, he went into gardening and doing lawns and stuff and made some real money. But as he gets older, and he and I are about the same age, he's wanted to get back into radio, but he doesn't want to do it as dramatically as I have. So Dave and I have done this. This is our second station that we've been at. Mm-hmm. I do the show, but Dave is on the phone with me from his home studio.
Cool.
And he's more technically oriented than I, and he keeps getting all these gizmos to make him sound almost like he's right there.
Well, the idea is for you to be able to do it from home. Then you could do it until you're 90.
Yeah, well, it just that probably just wouldn't work. Uh-huh. But as long as one of us has to be at the radio station.
So he's technically the show's producer?
Guess you'd say. I mean, it's hard... Describe it. I think it's just basically we're friends and we've been at this a long time and we don't take each other too seriously, and that's probably good. We haven't showed up in the ratings yet. I mean, it's technically possible that we could, but it would be something like a 0.5 if we did,
right?
Or a 0.6, because we'd be rated in the Albany Metro. Now, what we go by is hustle and BS, I guess.
Well, you know what? That's all time.
No radio standbys.
Yeah. Let me ask you. You made a film. You did a documentary about Amsterdam. I mean, I know we're going back to the whole upstate New York history thing, but you made a movie about Amsterdam history, in fact, didn't you?
Right. I've done some work over the years with the local public television station, WMHT, and for a while I was working on documentaries with a great filmmaker named Steve Dunn. Unfortunately, Steve Dunn is done at the public TV station. They let him go a couple years ago in a cost move. He was a great filmmaker. And I had the privilege of working with him on a couple of projects, two of which I was co-producer, one about Amsterdam and the other about the downtowns of the major cities up here, Albany, Schenectady, and Troy. In particular, Amsterdam, I would have to say, was like a work of, a labor of love for me. And it was, you know, more intense than a lot of these PBS local history shows, just because I was starting to do research on Amsterdam history. And Steve is a real painstaking filmmaker, and it worked out very well. The show's 5 years old, and they're still showing the baby.
Cool.
Every time I turn around, it seems somebody's calling my talk. Gee, Bob, I saw you last night, you know, on Channel 17. You know, they or WMHC, they don't call it 17.
Well, the history doesn't change. I mean, it's still
what
you reported on back then, or what the stories that you told.
Yeah, it was a real moneymaker for him.
Good.
You know, for the public TV station, because Amsterdam was just thrilled to have a documentary done about it, you know, and there was a lot of material there that hadn't been covered, the different ethnic groups, you know, the Poles, the Italians, the Jews, the Latinos, you know, and also the history of the carpet mills, and we even went back to colonial times, and we just did a lot of stuff. It was an epic. It took us over a year to make it. It was a 90-minute production.
Were you behind the camera, or were you sort of,
No, he was behind the camera. Okay. I was in front of it. I was the narrator, but I was also mainly the script writer.
Cool.
But he was the shooter, and he was also the editor. I mean, we even had a crew. I mean, he had another couple of guys actually shooting. It was great, and it was again a real privilege to work with Steve. It's too bad he can't seem to get a place to practice his art, his craft anymore. Because I used to tell him, I said, I sometimes think we're becoming like Gilbert and Sullivan. You know, people thought of us together. Oh, Cudmore and Dunn and Cudmore. You know. Had a lot of interesting things to say.
Any disasters? Any like, oh my God?
There are. I can't really you know put a name to them, but you know, like the people. Because I'm interested when they pitch me on a show. I'm mainly interested in stories or people that have something to say. So the worst thing for me is somebody who, you know, it's just BS. You know, they got nothing to say.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, go to my website at themillionairecode.com. You know, and you'll find out.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, I'm looking for some story. Like, I talked to a woman today about how she visited all these baseball parks. I think she was from the publicity.
Oh, was she good?
Because
I have her book, and I was thinking about... She was good? Cool.
Yeah, I like practically anybody with the story. And I can hardly wait now. I've got the sex therapist coming on tomorrow.
I'm sure you blocked out like a full half hour for her.
I'm ready to go.
What about famous people? Have you done... Well, especially when you were on the 50,000 Watt?
Yeah. Well, it's funny. Not too many. I mean, I talked to people like Mario Cuomo, you know, like the governor, but, you know, he would do a regular thing with him. I have interviewed Kirk Douglas over the years, you know, the Amsterdam connection.
And you interviewed him in Yiddish, which I thought was really good.
That was an interesting thing. I only interviewed him for about 5 minutes, and that was, but it was interesting. And, I've talked to Walter Lantz, the creator of Woody Woodpecker.
Cool.
I don't know.
Have you taped all these things, or did they just go into the ozone?
I'm very bad at that. I probably better now. I'm saving more things now with digital audio, but I'd be hard put to find anything that I did years ago. You know, thousands of hours of shows, you know, thousands of interviews, they're all gone.
We'll count this among the archives because we'll preserve you here on Dave's Gone By. I want to thank so much Bob Cudmore. Please listen to his radio show. You can hear the Bob Cudmore Show on WVTL out of Amsterdam, New York. It's 1570 AM, 1570WVTL.com to listen on the Internet if you're not from upstate, so listen anywhere. Bob, I want to thank you so much for visiting the neighborhood. You've been a great guest.
Well, thanks a lot, Dave, and you have a good day.
You too.
Take care.